All right, we'll get started here. Welcome to the fourth session of GradUConn today. And my name's Courtney. I work at UChicago Grad, and I'm pleased to be presenting the Green Jobs panel. We have four alumni and a moderator gathered to share some information on this dynamic field. Before we get started, I just wanted to run through a couple of things. If you've been attending panels so far today, this should be nothing new. First, just to remind you that this is the end of the day, one of many panels. And if for some reason you couldn't make one of the panels earlier today, we hope to in the future have audio recordings available. And I'll talk about the Zoom features in a minute, but before we do that, I just wanted to launch a quick poll to get a sense of who is in the audience, particularly because this is a broad topic and folks could be coming from a lot of different directions. It'd be great for us to know who you are. So if you wouldn't mind taking a moment to fill that out, that would be great. And while you do that, I just want to highlight a couple of features of the Zoom software. We will be using the Q&A feature to field questions. So if during the panel you have questions for our panelists or our moderator, we ask that you put them in there rather than the chat box. And then about halfway through the panel, our moderator will begin to field those questions. If you end up having a technical issue or want to communicate directly with me, you can use the chat function. All right, and it looks like we have our poll results. Oh, this is great. So most folks are, or majority, largest number are master students, but we also have a good number of PhD students, postdocs, and a few alumni. And this may be one of the best dispersions in terms of disciplines I've seen today. So folks from biological sciences, Graham School, Harris, humanities, physical sciences is a winner by a little bit, molecular engineering, SSA, and social sciences. So this should be a really nice conversation. I'm so glad to get people from a lot of different fields. All right. And I'll just put up one final slide to share who's going to be present today. Our panel will be moderated by Mike Hogue, who's a professor of theology, ethics, and philosophy of religion at the Meadville Lombard Theological School here in Chicago. And Mike holds a PhD from the Divinity School in Theological Ethics. Kate Stell, also from the Divinity School with a master's in Divinity, who's currently the volunteer coordinator at Riverview Gardens, and Chelsea Grassfield, graduate of the MAF program, who's currently a policy specialist at Friends of the Chicago River. Jeff McMahon, who's a senior contributor and environmental writer at Forbes, also a writing mentor in the MAF program. And Caroline Taylor, director of R&D at Earthshift Global, and an alum of the chemistry PhD program. So with that brief overview, I will turn things over to Mike for our first few questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Courtney. It's good to be here with all of you, and thank you to all the panelists who are here willing to share their experience with us today. And I'm going to get started with some pretty general questions and just ask the panelists to answer sort of organically. The first, there are no surprises here, but the first question is going to be just a general one, which is tell us about your current job and what kind of activities you do as a part of that job, and is this what you prepared yourself to do through grad school? So why don't we go ahead and start with Jeff?
Okay, hi, I'm Jeff. I'm a senior contributor at Forbes. I've been doing that since 2011, and before that, I was writing for a couple of years for a little smaller startup. I write about the environment. I'm an environmental reporter, and I've been focused exclusively on climate change since 2008. Of whether this is what I prepared for in school and grad school is an interesting one, because I was a reporter before I went to grad school for 15 years at newspapers in California. And then I came, I went to the MAF program and got a master's in humanities and studied really always curious about. they offered me this teaching job at the university afterwards. So I stayed on, and for about 5 years I just taught, and I didn't practice journalism. I did some creative nonfiction, some more creative writing. But then I started to miss the journalism. And so I started looking for ways back. At that time, digital journalism was taking off. That was kind of my on-ramp to get back into the field. So that wasn't a specific intention when I went to graduate school, but I didn't enter math with a vocational intention, like to do a certain kind of job. I just wanted to study. And some skills that I learned in math have been really, really, really useful in the field of digital journalism, including argument, because this is a world now where your readers speak back to you. Sometimes from a, you know, when you're writing about climate change, you get some pushback times. And to be able to analyze arguments on the fly and to be able to write very quickly and voluminously, those are skills that I really, really improved when I was in grad school at U of C.
I'm sure a lot more follow-up at some point soon, but I want to give a chance for some of our other panelists to jump in. Is any one of you ready to go, or should I just call on names? Anybody want to jump in? All right, how about Kate?
Sure, I can. I'm happy to go next. I am, like you said, currently working as a volunteer coordinator at an organization in central Wisconsin in the Fox Valley called River Reubens. My initial background is in religious studies. At the university, I was in the Divinity Master of Divinity student, but my interest in that degree was mental and environmental issues. So I personally find that the work I'm doing is, you know, was definitely related to my graduate work. I don't think people often, if I plan to use my degree, but I actually feel like I use it all the time. So as the volunteer coordinator, I do, work with communities, work with individual volunteers all the time, every day. Well, not right now. when there isn't a pandemic, I work with them every day. So I do a lot of community engagement work. I do some content creation, mostly like written on our website and things like that for newsletters. I also, though, work in the daily operations of our different social enterprise areas, two of which are our organic urban farm and our hydroponic greenhouse. So I'm working side by side with volunteers and our job training program participants, which is really what our mission is all about. It's around our ServiceWorks job training program. So we host volunteers for that program at places like the urban farm and the hydroponic greenhouse. So in terms of how my MDiv prepared me for this work, I think the most important thing was anytime you're working in the community and working with, like we do with vulnerable populations, I think it's really important to have awareness of yourself, your own bias, your own, I don't want to call it baggage, but the things that you're bringing to those sorts of interactions. And that was something we worked on a lot in the Master of Divinity program. So that has been really, really valuable. And to be honest, Riverview Gardens is a secular organization, so no, I'm not utilizing things that I took classes on necessarily, but as a ministry student, we are also dealing with people's values and what's important to them and about making change, and that's really how I understand my role with Riverview Gardens. So it might seem disconnected, but it isn't for me.
That's great, Kate. And what year did you graduate?
I graduated in June 2019.
Oh, so real recent. Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
And then Jeff, what year did you graduate?
Sorry, I had to unmute. I graduated in 2002.
All right. Chelsea, tell us about what you do.
Sure. Hi, everyone. So I am policy specialist at Friends of the Chicago River, and my job is sort of twofold. I work with elected officials on getting them to care about the river and make policies that are good for the river. I work primarily with the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District. They're the folks that treat Chicago's wastewater and discharge that treated wastewater into the river. So they're a large stakeholder. I attend all of their board meetings. And then on the other side, I do a lot of research on water quality issues. So things like dissolved oxygen, chlorides, nutrient pollution. And so to that question about whether or not my studies prepared me for that. So my background is I'm an elementary school teacher. And I came to UChicago, just as Jeff said, I wanted to do math to study. Like I just wanted to go back to school and study some more. And I really didn't know what I was going to do afterwards. And my thesis is analyzing the translation of a Spanish text. So, but during my time at MAF, I took a class at Harris, and we worked with the Metropolitan Planning Council on the Our Great Rivers initiative. And that one experience was enough to get me interested in policy. And then after graduation, just reflecting on, I am from California, so reflecting how much nature and the environment has always been very important to me and in my life, I realized that that's what I wanted to do. And so, so that's math. And I would say having, even though I wasn't doing policy things specifically in math, and my classes were like in Latin American literature, and all of the skills about writing and research, those are the things that have served me immensely in my role. And I've, that translates to anything, I think, are those skills.
Great. So far there's a theme about how your degree program has prepared you, and that's, it's the research writing and communication skills that are portable across fields and across employment sectors, I guess, rather than specific content or research. Let's see if that's the case with Caroline.
Sure. I think actually, let me come on up. I think it's characteristic sustainability more than anything else. I think when you talk to people working in this field, you're going to hear that kind of thing a lot. So I'm Caroline Taylor. I am Director of R&D for Earthshift Global. We are a boutique sustainability consultancy. We work with companies large and small, government agencies, NGOs, going down the chain on assessing sustainability and environmental impact of products, of services, and of decisions. So a large part of my role is in method development for how we make robust analyses. We quantify things that are traditionally very difficult to quantify. And also, I work a lot on client engagements as well, where we're really trying to drill down into understanding an impact or how we might assess an impact. Is this what I trained for? Directly? No. Indirectly? Very, very close overlap. So my background is in chemistry, chemical physics, in theory, which means a lot of looking at how complex systems interact with each other. And when you unpack it at the end of the day, that's what sustainability is. It's how changes in different parts of a system cause changes elsewhere. And if we understand the mechanism, then we can make decisions about how to move forward or what to do. So a large part of what I do does actually involve fundamentals. I did a lot of simulation and statistical mechanics as a grad student postdoc. And a lot of sustainability assessment uses those methodologies, including some of the emerging techniques that we work on at Global. I also use a lot of the critical thinking and ferreting out information skills that you develop as part of a research program, and a lot of communication, a lot of interdisciplinary work, and a lot of learning how to listen to and incorporate a wide variety of values and stakeholder opinions and positions, because as Kate says, it's a very value-driven space. So when you were asking when people finished, I finished in 2003.
And I was 2018.
You're 2018, Chelsea. Okay. So we've got a couple of recent grads, Chelsea and Kate, and a little further back, Jeff and Caroline. And I'm myself 2005, so I'm the Jeff and Caroline generation, I guess. All right, that was all really, really interesting. You're all doing very interesting work, research, writing, community engagement, policy analysis, systems work. And I think Caroline's right that part of what, I mean, we're hearing thematic kinds of connections in each of your stories, and that's partly because of the training you've received at the U of C, but probably largely because the sustainability field or the environmental field is so inherently multidisciplinary and affects everybody that it requires a lot of general skills in thinking and communication and analysis and the rest of what you've described. So the next question I'd like to ask, and a couple of you already addressed it, Jeff in particular already addressed it, and so I'll leave him to add anything he might want to at this point, but specifically to the others of you, how did you get to where you're at from grad school? I mean, Kate and Chelsea, it wasn't long ago that you were in school, but was there, I mean, Chelsea, you described a single class that kind of changed things for you, but is there any more to that? I mean, did you do something in the interim? Was it about networking and knowing the right people? Was it luck? Was it something that you were aiming for? And, you know, whatever. How would you answer that question? How'd you get to where you are from grad school? And why don't we start with Kate this time?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I was not really job searching that long ago. I started this position in September 2019. So I'm still pretty new in the organization. And like I said, I graduated in June. So I, I would say that a year ago, this is maybe not the position that I would have seen myself in particular, or necessarily the kind of organization. But as I was job searching, I really started to find positions at organizations that I was interested in that I would not have guessed that I was interested in. So I kind of naturally started to broaden my search while I was on the job market. But I think to kind of back up a step, I entered the Master of Divinity program with an interest in doing community-based environmental work. That kind of shifted during my graduate studies, but I anticipated, or at least maybe saw it as a real possibility, that I would be working at a secular organization because the world of like faith-based environmental action is really still growing. So working at a secular organization was definitely something that was, they were jobs that I was pursuing, I guess I could put it that way. But, you know, View Gardens in particular, I actually, this where I live now is really close to where I up, which I was not expecting at all. But I came across this organization, which is pretty young. So when I graduated college, in 2015, they were only a couple years old. So, because I went to college pretty close to here as well. And I had never heard of them. So I was like, what is this organization that is like really cool and doing all of this dynamic work in this area that I grew up? Who are they? And so I really started to look into their mission, which involves social transformation and environmental transformation. And I was really interested. And they were hiring for actually a temporary, a seasonal position. And I applied because I was interested in the organization. And so when I was invited to interview for the position, I immediately really put forward that I was looking for a permanent position. And then the conversation really became about how we could work together to make that happen. Which was really exciting. And I'm really passionate about the work that I'm doing at Riverview Gardens. So for this particular position, there was no, you know, I didn't have any connections with anyone at Riverview Gardens. It happened to be like sort of in the general area of where I was from, which was just kind of a coincidence. So I remained close to family, which was really attractive to me as I was going through my job search. And it was an organization that I felt was really community-based, which, you know, the work that I'm doing is slightly different, like I said, than I would have guessed just a year ago from now. But there are so many of the big level things, the higher level aspects of what I wanted to do that I'm in this role, that it's really, really a good fit. So for me, it kind of became about thinking more flexibly and more creatively about these like larger scale issues that I'm passionate about. And just also being really forward in my interview process about what I was hoping for. And it just ended up being a really good fit.
Great. Thanks, Kate. I have a similar story. About getting hired for a temporary thing that ended up turning into, fortunately, a long-term thing. But it sounds like, to me, the point that you're making is that really you broadened your search and your idea about what the right place could be by focusing at a mission level, like what is this organization about, rather than what particular things are they doing or what particular skills or job description is at hand. So I think that that's probably an interesting thing for us to come back to. I want to move along to, let's hear from Chelsea. How'd you, from translating Spanish literature to working on river policy, that seems like a leap.
Yes, it was quite the leap. Upon graduating, I still really didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't even know what was out there. I didn't even know what was possible. And I depended a lot on the grad office. Courtney and I are really good friends now because I was constantly in her office. I was at all the workshops for resumes and cover letters, because you don't really have to do that with teaching. Out in California, there's just the system you use. And so all of that was really new to me. But I figured that nonprofits would be like an equivalent sort of like mission-based, you know, I didn't want to just join a corporation, did a drive. And so, so I started to look at nonprofits and sort of kind of like Kate was saying, I just, it was odd, like I was applying to ones that I found had interesting missions, but just the jobs were kind of all over the place, like mostly research and writing, but like sometimes volunteer stuff. And the organizations were all over the place. Like one was like a running nonprofit, then it would be like history makers. So they compile African American, they just were all over the place. So it took a lot of reflecting before I started to realize, like in my spare time while I was looking for a job, that I was volunteering at nature preserves and at the park district and sort of like with the shed and doing beach cleanups to realize like, okay, I think this is what I want to do. So then, so volunteering was a big way to sort of explore. So I would highly recommend like anyone who's close to graduating, start volunteering, trying stuff out. Big resume boost, like, you know, with the park district, you're volunteering for the park district, but also the Nature Conservancy, but also, so you can, I would like change the title of whoever it was for the volunteer, depending on the application. Coffee chats, I made a LinkedIn while I was at East Chicago and just started randomly asking people to come to coffee with me. And they would, so that was really great. Getting to learn about what other people were doing, made great connections. And then I actually ended up, I kept in touch with the Metropolitan Planning Council and reached out to them. It was like looking for a job for like 5 months, I think. Reached out to them and I was like, did you ever do anything with that research project that we did for you? Cause like, maybe I could put that on my resume and it would boost, you know, that. And keep working for us as a research assistant, so as a as an intern, and so I did that, and that all, like, I had no idea what a well-connected organization that was, so that was huge for networking as well. By the time I interviewed at Friends, I had already met my supervisor. He had already seen me at MPC things. And so, and even like when I started at Friends, like I'd go to meetings and see a bunch of people that I had networked with, like it was really helpful, but it took me a long time. People would always tell me interviewing like, well, you know, yeah, your teaching experience, like I can see how that's really relevant because I would really sell myself and that experience, but they just like, there was something there that they just didn't want to leap of faith with me. So I really think that the internship at MPC is what fit for me.
All right. There's new insight there too. The importance of volunteering as a way to gain experience. And then what I, the other thing I heard you saying was connecting to connectors, people who are well networked and really not being shy about reaching out to those, getting on their radar. Okay. Caroline, and then I'll ask if Jeff wants to add anything to what he previously shared.
Sure. Yeah. Victory, you said, was it luck or something else? A lot of luck and a lot of collaboration. So this is the other thing that I get that is, I think, very uniquely a power from University of Chicago. And that's, we have an incredibly collaborative culture. The physical sciences division as a whole, but the university itself, not just the divisions. There is an expectation of collaboration and engagement outside your discipline. And I don't think that's changed since I've been there. Certainly it hasn't when I meet up with colleagues. So did I know that this was my path? Not even close. I was a traditional academic, just like I think many of us in going into University of Chicago and coming out are. So I did a traditional postdoc and went out and worked with Ben Whittem at Cornell. And then I got super lucky and more tenure track jobs the year I looked in my field. And I insanely luckily got one of them and continued there to collaborate, in my case, with experimentalists in biology and other people in. And a couple of years into that, we got a call, my biology, plant biologist collaborator and I, from somebody who was setting up a new institute at Cal, UC Berkeley, that was actually funded by BP of all people. And this was the Energy Biosciences Institute. And it was a $500 million award to Berkeley, Lawrence Livermore Lab, and University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And the director of that institute called because he knew one I was working with and said, hey, could we convince you guys to come and start an interdisciplinary team within the institute looking at how all these things relate? And so we talked about it and did. It was an amazing transition. It was scary. It was very scary to decide to walk away from the tenure track, given how we're trained and given everything that I thought was who I was going to be. But fundamentally, it was about expanding the levels of collaboration. Shortly after that transition, we started working on more of the sustainability issues and how we could assess the sustainability issues from a strategic perspective. And the rest was kind of history. So I worked there for, I guess, about 5 years. And then I was ready to move a little further. And that's about when I started working with AirShift Global. And one of the big drivers for that whole transition, it's like Chelsea, I grew up in California, and I grew up paying a lot of attention to water rights in California and water restrictions and in the desert Southwest. So I already had a piece that was kind of background processing of there are some really important environmental issues. And as a scientist, at some point, you often get to have some big impact on the policy space, but it happens when you're retired. It happens late career. And getting an opportunity to influence the discussion and try to provide robust, defensible underpinnings for it was really exciting. And so that trajectory was mostly luck, a lot of collaboration, and a fair amount of networking, a fair amount of picking up the phone when someone had questions. And that's actually, it continues to be a large part of what I do. And it's been really valuable. And at the end of the day, that collaboration piece is probably the single most important component.
Thanks a lot, Caroline. So I'm gonna jump in here. We want to turn relatively soon to the conversation with the audience, but I want to ask a last question, and I'll start with Jeff, and it's actually bridging some of what Caroline just said and what Jeff said earlier. So Caroline's just mentioned that that's a big deal to leave a tenure track job and to go into essentially a startup. I mean, a $500 million startup, it's a new thing still. But she said part of her reasoning was that there was the opportunity to be more engaged as a change agent, really, sooner rather than later. And Jeff, you used the language of vocation, which for some of us, especially in religious studies and divinity school, has a lot of meaning. And the shorthand I use in talking with my students about it, and comes from someone else, I don't own it, but it's a concept that's relevant here, is that vocation is meeting the world's need, meeting the world's deepest needs with your greatest gifts. And I think a lot of folks in the sustainability field are motivated to do work in the green area out of some sense of making a contribution. Jeff, you used that language specifically. So tell us about, why is it that you're invested in this environmental reporting and especially this work on climate issues, given how politically fraught it is?
So the investment in environmental reporting goes back, further back than I can remember. It has something to do with my relationship with nature that started in childhood. And when I worked at newspapers before I went to grad school, none of them had an environmental beat. So I had to do other things. I had to cover politics or city hall or crime. I was a movie reviewer. I was a columnist. But I was always the guy who would go to the oil spill, or I always volunteered to do the environmental story. And then I went to grad school and had been teaching for 5 years. It was 2008. I'd been teaching and not practicing journalism for 5 years. I really missed it. The climate crisis was building. There was a lot of momentum in society building up toward the Copenhagen Climate Conference. And I was really itchy to get out there and cover it. But newspapers were in free fall, and so were magazines. So how was I going to do that? So I started looking for some sort of digital outlet. And somebody posted on Facebook a story from the Wall Street Journal about a little startup called TrueSlant that was trying to figure out how how to make journalism work online. And so I just sent an email out of the blue to the CEO. And I said, hey, you guys need an environmental reporter. Look at what's going on. They had all the beats covered, but they didn't have an environmental reporter. And then, you know, I sent them links to some stuff I'd published, and I'd won some awards in environmental reporting. So I portrayed myself as if that's what I had always been doing. And I'll be honest, I sent that email from a uchicago.edu email address. And I'm, you know, it's mere speculation whether that was impactful or not, but I suspect that it was. You know, I think it's an institution that people take seriously. And if I had written from Gmail or Mac.com, which I use, it may not have had the same effect.
All right, thanks, Jeff. I want to ask, is there anybody else that really wants to add in to this particular question, or are you all willing to move into the open discussion?
I'd love to comment on something Jeff just said,
okay.
And that's the be bold. Reach out. This is a different world than some of us grew up in. And that university, we have a huge benefit that we're coming from University of Chicago. Huge. And so we should totally leverage it. But also this, just reach out to people that are doing things you're interested in. And Chelsea said the same thing about reaching out on LinkedIn. You never know. My job didn't come from an existing channel. My job came through like a third degree connection from passing on comments. You never know what's gonna be interesting, but if you have something interesting to share, Jeff's comment about sending stuff is a huge one.
All right, thank you. And I can't help but to point out that each one of you has taken some sort of a leap of faith to move into the work that you're doing. Caroline was just speaking, but I'm now turning to the audience questions. And this is a question specifically for Dr. Taylor from an audience member. Says, there are chemists looking forward to working in industry, but they're also passionate about sustainability, and that's informed their decision to apply to certain green-minded companies. The question is, do you recommend people try to get right into this field from the get-go, or gain experience as a chemist, STEM industry professional before thinking of applying to a job like yours?
That's a really good question. I think a lot of the answer has to do with which part of the chemistry or the science you're doing you enjoy most or are most passionate about. Do you like getting your hands wet? Then I think the opportunity then is to work in the field, but emphasize when you're looking and talking to people that you want to be involved in shaping the sustainability of what you work on. Because those lines, the bright lines, aren't really there anymore. I think choosing companies that seem like-minded is a really good idea. I think you want to pay attention to companies that might not traditionally seem like-minded. So there are actually a number of firms that we view as the conventional behemoths that actually have pretty significant efforts driving their sustainability. The area that I work in and much of what my company does takes some additional experience, particularly for the kind of modeling and analysis that underpins much of what we do. So to work with a company like us as a job, as opposed to working as an intern to learn a little bit more, does take generally a little bit more training in the methods that are used. That said, you can get a lot of that working in your traditional field. There is no one path, not anymore, not for this. And a lot of the people that I work, in fact, HP is a company a lot of people are familiar with. They do a lot of work that has an underpinning of sustainability as a component. I did my graduate work with Carl Fried and Stuart Rice, and my first meeting at HP was with someone who had graduated from Stewart's group 10 years ahead of me. No idea. That it's there. These paths all intersect now. But a lot of people come up from working in the technical side. And if you're looking at implementation or wanting to actually change a process, having that experience is invaluable because you can sit down with other people and have credibility. You know what's going on the production line. And you know what factors are changeable or are not changeable in an analysis. I know that's not a distilled down answer. And unfortunately, there is not a bright line answer. But seeking out opportunities where you would get to do some of both, I think is the best first path.
Okay. Thank you. And there's the next question. This is a really important question. I mean, the other one was important too. They're all important, right? There's no bad questions, but this is a really important question, I think. Thanks for sharing your perspectives, everyone. The questioner is curious how you stay motivated in this line of work when any environmental work, particularly as it pertains to climate change, feels like such a losing battle. And I just open that up to anyone. I guess maybe Carolyn's had a couple of turns recently. I'm sure she's got lots of thoughts, but let's hear from someone else at first.
I have some thoughts. So I was actually thinking about this, you know, when I was jotting down some notes for myself about, in preparation for this panel, because while the organization that I work for, Riverview Gardens, involves, you know, some really, really interesting and cool, like, environmental and sustainability, activities, first and foremost, we're an organization about people and maybe social work or job training and ending unemployment and poverty and homelessness. And we do that through these sort of innovative environmental methods. So when I first joined Riverview Gardens, I had some hangups about, you know, we use a lot of disposable single-use plastic because we grow food. We grow vegetables that we sell to the public. And that's often packaged in plastic, or we have to wear gloves. And we're a nonprofit organization who works with volunteers who are not farmers. We have one real farmer, you know, so we're working with non-experts all the time. That's really what we're all about. And I was like, you know, we could do better than this, right? You know, like this doesn't have to be this way. And obviously, you know, these are maybe trivial things in the scope of climate issues as a whole. But in terms of the work that I'm doing, I had to take a step back and look at the fact that it's really about the community first for me. For the work that I want to do, the work that I'm doing right now, and the things that I'm passionate about, it's about making space for people to have the potential for a transformative experience with the land. And so at Riverview Gardens, we do that around issues of poverty and unemployment. But if I were to go into those interactions with the community and with people who are experiencing homelessness and food insecurity on a daily basis and tell them that they were wasting gloves, it's just so counterproductive. It's not the message that we're going for, and it's ultimately working against this larger scale goal that I have and that I think Riverview Gardens is working towards. So for me, I really try to pay attention to, in terms of the day-to-day work that I'm doing, not getting too bogged down in some of these smaller things with my work in the community. Because we can, in my opinion, we can make space for these larger scale problems on a communal or social level through these sorts of individual and small level interactions with community members, so.
Okay, thank you, Kate. Any others of you want to respond to this?
I have a response, if you like. So I have a one-word response, but I'll elaborate on it a little bit. The one word is meditation. Just having a practice that gives you the ability to observe your own reactivity and to know it when it arises and to know that it doesn't make you more effective at what you're trying to accomplish, I think is really important. There's a group that's called Zen Peacemakers that I think has kind of figured out this problem. And they have three principles. The first one is not knowing. We don't actually know what's going to happen. The second one is bearing witness. We can see what's happening now. And the third one is taking action. And the idea is when you bear witness, when you see something that needs to be addressed, you take action to solve it. But if you think you know what the outcome is going to be, you're in trouble. You know, if you start thinking like we're doomed because of climate change, it's going to be really hard to keep working. So we don't actually know what's going to happen. We just have to keep trying to make it better.
Thanks, Jeff. That's a great response and very intriguing. Chelsea, Caroline, you want to add to this?
Yeah, so especially with COVID-19 and the recent things with like now plastic bags have been banned, and even before that, reusable drinks weren't being allowed at like Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts. And that makes sense. Like, if you don't wash your reusable bags, yes, they will harbor germs, and we shouldn't at this moment be spreading those around. But it's disheartening to see articles where the plastics industry is like, well, we told you this was going to happen, and that's why plastic bags are good. And they're working to repeal, to ban the bag bans is what's being said. Also, keeping in mind that Trump is quietly undoing things. The EPA has given the green light for polluters to just pollute, and they can just claim that it was COVID-19, and that's why they can't comply. And it's up to them to decide if that's in fact true. So, yes, those things can be really disheartening. And it's, I like what Jeff has said, and I'm going to look up these Zen Peacemakers and maybe some of that. But yeah, it's it helps to have really passionate coworkers, I think, because you can sort of, you can vent these things out, and it's a sympathetic ear. I think there's something else I was going to add, but it's slipped my mind. So if it comes back up to me, I'll bring it back up, but I'll let Caroline go for now.
I'll give you a one word as well: therapy. As a good Californian. Now, actually, this is a really, really important question. And it is can be a really big challenge. Chelsea's comment about passionate coworkers. Sometimes someone else can be passionate while you're struggling. There are times where it's hard to keep doing the work. To be real candid about that, it's hard not to look at things and think, am I moving deck chairs on the Titanic? If you'll excuse the cliche. But Jeff made the comment that you don't know what's going to happen. There's a lot of bad that I want to acknowledge with COVID-19, but I also want to point out that our emissions are way down. Our air pollution is way down. There have been a number of neat infographics looking at this. That's going to change our emissions trajectory for a while to come. We don't know what that means yet. And if I'd given up and crawled into a burrow already, then I can't take advantage of that. Doing things to remind yourself of the people directly affected by the work you do. So yeah, things are challenging. But the most vulnerable populations globally that are going to be impacted by climate change in particular, they benefit from any improvement. So, yeah, it may sometimes be really challenging to deal with feeling like you're fighting a losing battle. But at the end of the day, if you reframe that a little bit, you recognize that it's actually a super important battle and people benefit with every single part of it.
Thanks to all of you for responding to that question. I'm just going to add a couple of thoughts to that before moving on to the next question. I mean, this is right at the heart of what I teach and write about is how to, essentially it's the moral challenge of climate and environmental crisis generally, and how we're really not shaped to think of these. I mean, there's something about the structure of these issues that doesn't fit the way we normally think about moral challenges, which tend to be interpersonal, scaled to the short term and the rest. And so how is it that we can turn environmental and climate issues in particular into a sticky moral problem that people are concerned with? Each of you has said that your interest in, or your turn to this work, was rooted in experience, some kind of experience with environmental concern. And each of you now, and especially Kate has brought this up, and Chelsea to some extent, shaping experiences for others so that they can begin to see and to feel these issues as moral challenges. I think I get asked the question about hope all the time. What gives you hope? Are there reasons to be hopeful or optimistic? And what I've been saying lately is no. I don't think that there are good reasons to be optimistic, but I think that that's a misunderstanding of the concept of hope, that we don't hope on the basis of reasons, but that we act in hope, and that can be generative of reasons over the long term. That's two very different things. But great responses. This is a really interesting discussion. I'm going to move on to another question. And this is about folks coming from the humanities in particular. So I think Kate, Chelsea, and Jeff, and then there's another question for Caroline I'll come back to. But this is specifically for those of you coming from a humanities background. How'd you transition from your humanities background to a green job? What skills from your degree were you able to transfer? What new skills and knowledge did you need, and how did you acquire them? You ready to dive in?
Jump in, yeah. I would just reiterate those research and writing skills. You're doing that a ton in the humanities. That's a huge skill that you can then apply anywhere to any position. As far as new skills, everything that I've learned, I've been using those existing skills. Like I am not a scientist, and yet I'm having to write research papers on chlorides or nutrient pollution, things that are just like way beyond my comprehension. But I'm relying on those well-set skills that I honed at UChicago to learn new things.
Thanks, Chelsea.
I'm not sure I could say that any better than Chelsea just did, but definitely the ability to analyze, to know how to read things is really, really a useful skill that can help you in any sort of seemingly unrelated field. So environmental reporting is really intimately connected to energy right now. And if you think about energy, every different form of energy, nuclear, solar, wind, petroleum, hydro, has a different science behind it, a different field of science. And to write about them, you have to be able to bone up really quickly on that knowledge. When I started writing for Forbes, it was the week after the Fukushima disaster, and there was a cloud of radioactive fallout drifting across the United States. That was my first story. You've got to like be able to write accurately about that stuff. And so you have to know how to do research on the fly. And that's a skill that I think, even though in the humanities you're learning how to do that with literature or art history or philosophy, you know how to go find resources and how to use books and how to use things online. And I think those skills are more important than actually possessing the content of knowledge.
I would also add that for me, so, you know, at a nonprofit, we're doing mission-driven work. And something that I have found to be really closely tied to my background in the humanities is like communicating and advocating for mission, right? So I really see my position, since I do a lot of different kind of work within Riverview Gardens, as connecting people to our mission, if I had to boil it down to the most basic thing. And so I often find myself, you know, when I'm speaking with people, presenting at, you know, different like community events, or writing, you know, writing things that are going out to volunteers or whatever, just having conversations with people, that I am advancing the case for why they should work with us, you know, why they should volunteer with us, or what it is that we are doing in the community that they're a part of. And I mean, it's really just like crafting an argument, and you're working within a particular vocabulary, right? Nonprofits kind of have like a vocabulary that they use, and, you know, a mission brand. And it's actually kind of shocking sometimes how much overlap there really is. I would say though that some new skills that I did not have really a lot, that I don't have a lot of background in, are for my particular organization, we do direct social work. I don't personally, we have people who are doing that direct social work, but there has been a learning curve for me working with people who are in very vulnerable places in their life. And obviously that's not going to be the case with everybody's work. But it was a really rapid period of growth for me when I started to kind of work on like shifting between those different groups that we're working with. And, you know, we talked a little bit about how this field is collaborative, and there's a lot of interdisciplinary, and, you know, there's just a lot of overlap with so many different areas that I think my graduate work did prepare me for that kind of like jumping around to different projects, you know, balancing different things, figuring out how to speak the language in different groups and things like that. So on the one hand, it was a learning curve, but I also do think I had some experience from my graduate work.
Well, thanks to all of you for answering that. I'll just observe that the question assumes that training in the humanities to get into a green job requires moving into a different area. And there are plenty of environmental humanities options. I mean, it's not increasingly so. I mean, environmental literature, environmental history, eco-theology, which is the area where I work, religion and the environment studies. Some of those are more traditional academic type jobs, but they are also of enormous consequence. I don't think you have the American environmental movement, for example, without an American environmental literature that precedes it and shapes consciousness and values to be concerned with the environment. But it's still a, you know, great question. And now I'm going to move to a question to Caroline. This is out of my league. I don't even understand the question entirely, but it's a two-part question. Would your company, for example, or a company like yours, hire someone straight from a chemical physics, stat mechanics, statistical mechanics, I think, background right now? Or what types of other modeling and analysis methods should someone from this background read up on first?
Yeah, it's a good question. One of the challenges is the areas that really leverage the parts of my graduate training that actually do overlap are really in the advanced methods development. So that puts them a little further out. There are a couple of main methodologies that are used. Life cycle assessment is the main one that's used to assess environmental impact. There are also some things that are used to assess broader impact, total cost assessment or sustainability return on investment, things like that, that you can read up on that will at least give you a working familiarity. But bear in mind that these are areas that people train and get certified. But that does bring another thing up. I'm not a humanities person, right? But I noticed this language of transition to. It's not a transition. And I think if you reframe how you're thinking and how you're talking about it, it matters. So we keep talking, and it's always coded about environmental impact. Sustainability is not just an environmental pillar. It would fall over if it were just an environmental pillar. Sustainability is environment, economics, and social. And all of these pieces have to work together, or it's not going to hold up. It's not sustainable. It's fundamentally a humanitarian and liberal arts issue. And there are huge intersections there. For the transition from physical sciences, it's recognizing where you can point to intersections just like in humanities. So if I'm working on an obscure molecular reaction, I have to find a way that that resonates, whether it's the ability to look at systems like that, whether it's that if I look four steps out, I can see how it connects to an environmentally important molecule, and so I can make a comment about the mechanism, whatever it is, you have to find those connections. And then something like the StatMech background becomes an added benefit, something you can point to say, I bring this to the table. And that will make a big difference.
All right, thank you, Caroline. This is another, I think, good general question that each of you will have something to say about. Given that environmental issues are ultimately universal and that they affect everyone, although in different ways, what have you found is the largest source of resistance to these issues? And what do you do in your work or life to connect with folks who don't see the issue in the same way that you do?
I don't. So I do work with volunteers who are working with us on the farm, doing organic farming. They're, you know, they whatever, who are very vocal about how climate change is a hoax. Like I've had literally like had this conversation. Like I'm in the Fox Valley in Wisconsin. It's not Chicago. It's not Berkeley. But my role in this job, but also, you know, in that conversation as another person, is not to convince them to think how I think. I'm there to provide them with an invitation to look at how this work can be transformative for the community as well as the land that they're working on. Host that space, make sure that it's a safe space for our different volunteers. But I just don't, depending on the circumstance, I don't, that's as far as I.
Other responses?
If you like. This is what I really like about writing for Forbes, actually. So in, you know, Forbes is traditionally this business magazine that had this focus on billionaires and their list of the richest people in the world and very conservative. And I'm not sure, but I think I might be the first person who ever wrote about the environment for them. And when I first started doing it, it was very uncomfortable because I would be writing about climate change and Steve Forbes would be writing about climate change isn't real. And what's interesting is that doesn't happen anymore. There's nobody there anymore saying climate change isn't real. For a while, they were hosting some of the worst deniers. And they've not only stopped doing that, they've taken their history of their articles down. And I don't get to see, you know, how those decisions are made behind the scenes. So I don't really know what's going on there, but some sort of reality is dawning on people around environmental issues. Now, my own approach has been to focus at Forbes on ingenuity and the things that human beings are, the enterprising things that human beings are doing to address environmental issues. And so even though Forbes has really broadened the kinds of writers they have, I'm an example of that, it's still considered a financial business magazine. It still tends to attract a conservative audience. And when you can show them that, for example, solar energy is now cheaper, you know, not only than nuclear, but it's cheaper than gas, natural gas, they take notice of that stuff and they think, well, maybe I'm investing in the wrong place. Maybe I should be investing over here. And so their motivation might not be about saving the environment, but if you can capture their motivation and put it to work saving the environment, it's not an easy thing to do, but sometimes it comes together, and I think that can work.
We run into this a lot because we work directly with the companies and many of the C-suite. So there's a thing that's happened in the last several of years, and that's the recognition of climate change as a, quote, material risk. It must now be dealt with in investor materials, in strategic planning. It is not something that can be hidden from anymore. And that has really shifted the willingness to think about climate change as a real issue. In a general sense, and what that says, and Jeff alluded to it, we wind up putting a lot of things on a financial basis. It pains me to do so, because money is not necessarily the best way to think about things. Do we really want to put all our values in financial terms? On the other hand, if you're trying to communicate with people who may have resistance for other reasons, pointing out the economic components can be very powerful. One of the ways that we do that is to monetize impacts. So there are ways to monetize environmental and other externalities, things that aren't traditionally included in the way something is priced. When you put those in the conversation, they're reacted to completely differently. And it's very much like Jeff's comment about showing people that solar is now less expensive than gas. It changes the conversation from a behavioral one to a decision-making and financial balance one, and that changes the discussion.
Chelsea, did you want to jump in? I think I saw you had something to add at some point I missed.
Yeah. So along those same lines that Jeff and Caroline are talking about, when dealing with politicians and trying to get them to make policies that are good for the environment, it's, in my opinion, it's sometimes a little less important to point out what's so great about it for the environment and more, this is why your constituents will really like it if you vote this way. You know, we talk a lot at Friends about how there's been like a flurry of studies about how good it is to be outside and how good nature is for you. And we live in an urban environment, those of us in Chicago and other cities, and how important park spaces are and all of that. And so if we can say to politicians, well, it's really good for your constituents, then that's great. And for us, we can get stormwater benefit. You know, if you've got more grass than that impervious surface, then we're pulling more water into the earth and preventing flooding, which is another benefit for humans alike. Yeah, it's good for people. It's good for economics. That's what we really try to sell. And I do feel like the elected officials that I work with, like, they're not evil anti-environment, you know, but they're thinking of the bottom line. You know, how much is this environmental thing going to cost, and what are the benefits? Turtles don't vote for me, that kind of a thing. So when keeping that in mind, we can have a productive conversation. And then they get to look like good guys when they pass the things that we do. And we can say, look at environmental champions, and, you know, we just roll with it, right? Like,
thanks, Chelsea. All right, so I think we've just got a few minutes left, I believe. I think this is a pretty short answer type question, and then we'll close with final comments. So short answer type question, which kind of data science related job can one find in the environmental sector, and where should one look for examples of positions like that?
That may be another one for me, because I'm on the big data board for Rutgers. Yeah, there are lots, because understanding quantifying environmental impact is often behavioral. It's understanding how things are used, how they're disposed of, the decisions that people make. So there are jobs at all sorts of firms where people are trying to extract trends and understanding out of either their operating data or out of consumer data, things like that. Obvious places to look, people with lots of data. So Amazon, Google talks a bit about that and have a number of GoogleX and Google.org activities. Facebook has some data science pieces that you may see come up once in a while, but also firms like Target, Amazon, and a number of electronics firms that are making smart devices. All of these are looking for how you might extract trends from the data and turn around. And from an environmental impact assessment perspective, we need a way to use that data. That gives our results much more concrete certainty. So there's work on the uptake side and on figuring out how to engage with that data, and a lot of work on the generation side for how to extract information and analyze that data to generate useful sustainability information.
Thanks, Caroline. So now I think we just have a few minutes left, and I'm going to ask each of you to offer a parting thought for the audience. If you were to boil down your best insight, your best kind of advice for folks that want to do work in the green jobs area, what would it be? And you give me one word or five or six, but not too much more than that.
Are you waiting for someone to jump in?
Sorry, yeah. Go ahead, jump in.
Connections. Connect and collaborate. Whether it's paid, whether it's not paid, look for the connections, look for the intersections, and reach out. Find a way to work with people.
Great. Thanks, Caroline. Others?
I would just say that there doesn't seem to be a linear path to these kinds of jobs. So you have to be persistent in what you want and what you're looking for, and just look for it everywhere and look for opportunities to engage with it, which is really different than, I think, the career path of someone who's in law or medicine or, you know, some field that's aiming for a particular profession.
I would say start exploring now. I'll reiterate volunteering. I started a blog. Someone said, you should start writing about the environment so that you have, like, none of my writing samples were about the environment. So I started a blog. So that I could demonstrate to people that, like, well, I am interested. And I did this, like, Californian perspective of, like, Chicago, Illinois environmental stuff. So just, like, find a way right now to be exploring this interest that you have in green jobs in kind of what Jeff was saying, like, in any way that you can. Look for it everywhere. Put your spin. Like, find something that seems really random, but make it environmental and demonstrate that interest while you're looking for a job.
Kate?
Yeah, I would say, I think I touched on this earlier, but, you know, think creatively about what you can bring. Because like we've all kind of talked about, there's environmental stuff really bubbling up in a lot of different places. So to echo some of what our other panelists have said, like, look for it in different places, but also think creatively about what you have to offer. And, you know, craft your materials, your application materials to reflect these different skill sets that you bring to different kinds of environmental work. Because I would not have thought I would be here, but like you might find it in unexpected places, so.
All right, well, thank you, Kate, Jeff, Caroline, Chelsea, Courtney, Kate, Holly, and all the people behind the scenes for helping to make this work. And most of all, thank you to all of you participants and the great questions that you've asked this afternoon. We hope it's been helpful, and we wish you all the best of luck in your endeavors, both in school and in employment and in life right now. So I think that's a wrap.
I would just want to say thanks to you, Michael, because you had the hardest job.
Oh, this was an easy job. You all made it very easy. Very interesting folks with lots of insight and experience to draw from. But thanks for that.
Thank you.
All
right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to reiterate, I'm happy to answer questions if someone wants to drop me a line by email.
Same.
Me too.
Likewise.
Yep, same here. All right, should we stay on? Do we need to check in with anybody?
I think we are all good if you are. So thank you all again. And if you want to share your email address in the chat, you can. Otherwise, folks can connect with you through the Alumni Association too. So
if you'll give me a moment to write mine in the chat.
Absolutely.
I think we've lost a number of people we've dropped off too.
Can this be posted with this information be posted with the publication of the webinar?
Right.
Okay.
We just want to be mindful of that in case some people don't want their email address out there.
Sure. Okay.
This has been one of my favorite conversations of the day.
Oh, so. You say that about all of them. Sure.
It's been a lot of fun to talk with you all. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, same.
Nice to meet you all.
Yep, likewise.
Very good. Okay. I will sign out now and wish you all well. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.